He is the new voice of talk radio, Alexander Danilov.
Hello and welcome back to Solutions Algae Radio. Got another great show lined up tonight, another great guest, something I've been talking about a lot throughout the years on the show, which is transparency, especially in the financial markets. And of course, there's so little of that these days, no matter what. But there are certain people that are trying to fight through the unbelievable opaqueness of everything that's going on in the financial markets. And my guest tonight is Chaim Bodek. He is the managing principal at Decimus Capital Markets. He's also the author of The Market Structure Crisis, and he's also known as a whistleblower who blew the whistle on so much of the corruption and the fraud in the financial markets and on the back end that we don't see, order fulfillment, things like that. So Chaim, thank you so much for coming on and for being courageous and stepping up to the plate.
Hey, great. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you on. So let's over the last couple of years, it's become a little bit more of a hot button issue as people are starting to learn more about high frequency trading, and they're being more victimized by high frequency trading. Even Goldman Sachs, to a large degree, was for a long time until they started getting involved and all that kind of stuff. But high frequency trading will always be there as long as technology is there. And there's so much to it that people don't know. So let's introduce what high frequency trading is and how it started to develop and how it became such a massive albatross around the noose of investors.
Yeah, I think one of the things that people get confused about is they tend to group automated trading, quantitative trading, and high-frequency trading, and also what we call electronic market making, all within the same kind of bucket. And, you know, I never had a problem with any of the you know, traditions I just mentioned, except the high-frequency trading tradition, which is the most recent of, you know, kind of beast to kind of emerge in the U.S. Stock market. I mean, most of the criticism I have are really oriented around the stock market, although to a degree some of the practices exist also in the futures and options markets. So, you know, HFT, you shouldn't think of it as the computerization of markets. You should think of it more of as, you know, a particular behavior that's centered around, you know, a few firms that tended to cross-pollinate and trade in a certain way. And you know, some of the properties that this strategy has is, you know, it tends to require, it needs to be fast. It needs to, and the reason being is the traders require to be at the top of the queue and to react to events much more, you know, much quicker than other trading strategies. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you want to dig more into that, but you know, it is quite different than many of the other traditions that existed with computerized markets for, you know, over 20 mm-hmm. years.
Yeah, like you said, there is a big difference there. Of course, at the core of it, you can't be in the trade, you can't be victimized by HFT unless you're in the trade and you put an order in. And there are ways that they have manipulated that aspect of it. They can front run, which we'll talk about as well. There's a lot of other things there. I was actually showing my buddy, I had a vertical spread on SunEdison I put on, I think, a week and a half ago or 2 weeks ago. Didn't work out that well, but I actually found a way to break even though the stock's collapsed. It's about to go into bankruptcy. That's a whole different thing. But I was showing him how it was being manipulated as soon as I put an order in and how they just manipulated the heck out of it, made my account P&L in the day go from flat or positive to about 3-4% red. So, I mean, major swings on just putting my order in at a level. So he just couldn't believe it.
I would argue that the markets, I mean, you know, are definitely any market participant who acts, and especially if you're you know, putting an order in that's aggressive, that's you know, you're going into the midpoint or you're taking liquidity, there's market impact that can be seen, but one thing to recognize is that it's not necessarily HFT strategies that are responding to you. I'd have to actually look at the situation to get a sense of it. You know, so but I think one of the things you're pointing out is, you know, traders are still, you know, even though we've had computerized markets for a while, traders are still unaccustomed to how the markets work, and how to interact with these algos that are you know, responding to you within milliseconds.
Yep, absolutely. And actually, page talking about the brokers, the brokerage houses, all that, the exchanges, how we get cheated out of certain things is how the structures produced on the back end, how orders are filled, when and where. You wrote here, this is page 22 for those keeping score at home. And other considerations that brokers can bifurcate their order flow by separately optimizing the economics of marketable and non-marketable orders in order to double dip. So let's explain what double dip is, because we associate double dipping with negativity, and obviously it's the same case here. Hmm. Whenever somebody or something double dips, we know there's something wrong there, whether it's somebody double dipping their wild wings you know, into the ranch sauce or the blue cheese, whatever you want, and you get disgusted, you order another another round of dressings or whatever, or somebody doing that.
Yeah, okay, well, that's a specific topic. Now, funny is that topic, and this is why, you know, market structure is so confusing to people. You know, that topic, which is payment for order flow and the routing of retail orders, that is not really a high-frequency trading issue.
Uh-huh.
It's really a well, let me just kind of go through the process and probably explain it better. Basically, professional traders, market makers, tend to desire, you know, they want to trade against uninformed order flow. They want to, the way to think of it is they don't want to trade against orders that are going to move the market and immediately move, you know, positions against them, right?
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to, you know, you're selling and they don't want the market to tank after you sell and they bought the other side of that. So, so what they do is they basically have, you know, techniques to categorize and measure, you know, sometimes what we call toxicity or the neutrality of traders, and they are willing to buy, and the practice is approved by the SEC. They basically buy the right to trade against neutral or uninformed traders, which tend to be the traders at the retail shop. So most of the retail brokers are basically selling market makers the right to trade against your order. The thing I think it gets people very confused about this practice is that the orders, you know, often, you know, do not make it to the exchange. They literally get sent to the market maker and they are traded off the exchange. We call that you know, in the dark or internalization. And the market maker is able to trade against you without subjecting your order to the competition of the market. All he has to do is match the price that he sees. And at times, you know, the better market makers will negotiate with the retail broker and give you what's called price improvement, you know, a slightly better price than at least what you could have seen in the market. That doesn't necessarily mean, you know, because there's midpoint orders and all that out there, that you actually did get the best price in the market, but it'll be a better price, you hope, than what's visible. Okay, so the double dipping that you talked about is really the retail broker is he's selling really his market orders to the upstairs market maker. The orders that he has that are you know, non-market orders, just going to rest in the book. Often the upstairs market maker is not interested in those orders. So what the retail broker can do is take the non-marketable orders. And these are the orders, you know, that would rest in the book that are not market orders. He would send those to particular exchanges that will pay him, pay the retail broker, you know, basically a kickback for having those orders posted on, you know, that exchange.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we call it double dipping. It's, maybe that's not exactly the best term for it, but what we're basically saying here is that the retail broker is really bifurcating his orders and sending them to whoever is willing to pay the most.
All right.
And the question is, does that mean the, you know, if the retail broker is trying to basically make the most money he can off that off all those orders,
mm-hmm.
and has very specialized relationships to go get the best kickback, you know, is that opposed to him fulfilling his fiduciary duty to get you the best price and the best execution?
Okay.
Yeah. So this is it's there are a number of people. There's some class action lawsuits. The Permanent Subpoena Investigations has looked at this. Generally, and this is back to my book, The Market Structure Crisis. Generally, regulatory bodies and law firms are making the claimer allegation that broker is abusing your order flow, abusing your order by trying to get these kickbacks.
Mm-hmm. Once again, I'm speaking with Chaim Bodek, Managing Principal at Decimus Capital Markets, the author of The Market Structure Crisis, and a man who's made it his mission to bring transparency to the markets and expose so much of the stuff that's going on in front of our face, but we don't see it. His website, chaimbodek.com, has a lot of different stuff on order type controversy, which we were just talking about now. I want to talk about how complicit regulatory bodies have been and the reasons for that, what you've seen on the internals. There's stuff that gets brought out in the news, and there's stuff that we don't see, conversations that are had between regulatory bodies and otherwise, between the government and traders. And we know how tied Wall Street is and Wall Street actions and activities are to governments and what gets passed and what doesn't get passed. So let's talk about that, because you talk about that a lot in the book as well. And this is through Chapter 6. There's a lot of stuff here. So I'd like to focus on that a little bit because of how important that is.
Yeah, well, if you talk about the relationships between the industry and the regulators, it's incredibly complex. I mean, when I entered, in 2011, I went to the regulators with my claims that that major exchanges were basically providing undocumented futures to preferred high frequency trading firms. And I watched that investigation kind of roll out, and it took 5 years before they hit their first target. Watching that process, really was watching the evolution and the interplay between the enforcement side of the regulation, the policy side, and of course the industry. And what you realize is that, that especially with regard to the issues that we're talking about in the market structure space, that there rarely is any black and white decision, even in terms of, what is defined as breaking the law. When you dig into these allegations or the practices, You just basically can't get a black and white response, and I think that's one of the reasons traders are so frustrated with the regulatory response.
Mm-hmm.
Is that it's basically what we're watching here is we're watching securities law evolve, we're watching the regulators evolve, and we're watching the industry evolve, and there is a lot of lobbying and fighting and stalemate, and it's not a pretty business, but hopefully, I would argue, right today we are in a much better place than we were in 2011.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think it would take that long, and there's still a long way to go. But when you talk about it, there's two ways to look at it. You can be conspiratorial. I'm not, and you can say, look, this is just the way change happens. Within the particular political, governmental, regulatory, and commercial setting we have. I mean, there's just basically too many stakeholders, and the interpretation of these securities laws is there are huge differences of opinions across different segments regarding
mm-hmm.
the same laws.
Mm-hmm. Well, that clouds a lot of stuff, though, Chaim, obviously, and that gets in the way of getting meaningful change. So sometimes that has to happen through litigation, has to happen through books coming out such as yours, such as Flash Boys, things like that, sometimes movies, whatever it might be. It has to happen through grassroots, it seems like, and there has to be some more groundswell. And even still, it could get suppressed because of the reasons you just mentioned and so many more, everybody that's tied in and things like that. So I guess the common thought is for people, as you just said, the proper follow-up would be, even though it's better, it could always be better, right? So
yeah, well,
let's talk about how I see this
issue. I mean, okay, so let's be clear here. You know, I'm known for having exposed, you know, what could accurately be described as basically backdoors into an exchange that allowed preferred high-frequency traders to get an edge over, even professional investors, right? And I forget about the retail guy. When I saw the Volkswagen scandal with the emissions, the algorithmic
emissions fraud.
The emissions fraud, whatever you call it. I'm thinking to myself, my God, this is the same type of practice where you have very, quite sophisticated people who are gaming the laws and gaming regulation and gaming the technology.
Mm-hmm.
We don't just see that there. We see that in privacy. We're seeing this type of issue, occur in many different separate industries where the common theme is we have, algorithmic, logic that has a legal and ethical component, right? And either these algorithms are obeying the law and operating ethically, or at times they're, they may act unethical, or they may break the law, or both, right? I mean, by definition, both you would expect. But so I think that's more of the problem here, is it's not just should people care about the markets. This kind of problem where experts who have a huge influence over lives by the literally by the algorithms they either operate or design or, introduce into the world. There really isn't a check and balance, or I would say that the old mechanism of just having, regulation and enforcement, that doesn't seem to be enough. You actually now have to have, you need to have a new type of regulator, a new type of watchdog that, it's kind of like your white hat, right? Who's seeking out, these incredibly complex abuses and bringing them to authorities. I mean, that's definitely what I did. And you see that in the other industries also. There was a whistleblower behind part of the VW fraud. So I think that's more of the concern, is that we're basically in a world now where the sophistication of these abuses or security law violations or other types of rule breaking is at a level now where the number of people who can intercept and alert and somehow mobilize an effort to shut them down. That group is becoming smaller and smaller, and I think that's more of the story of what I think my experience was.
So at that point, when someone gets exposed for something, they're already trying to move on to something else. They're still milking everything that they can from the other side, what they've been doing. They'll keep tapping that well till things get worse, and then they abandon them when it gets really bad or it gets whatever, either financially or otherwise, image-wise. So there's a chance they're moving on to something else, and that's got to be a little bit of a concern there as well, because they always got to stay ahead of the game if they're doing something wrong. That's just the nature of it. So what should we look at? What are you seeing? What are you noticing as trends, the people moving away from the more sinister, so to speak, ways that they were doing business to other ways that's even darker than before, more myopic than before?
Well, I mean, look, I'm not really worried about the next big thing. I think another thing people don't understand is how much time it takes. You know, the practices that I called out are over, you know, they're around 10 years old now.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a huge amount of time for, you know, let's say there's an abusive practice for it to basically, you know, become, have an industry immersed in that practice can take, you know, can take a decade, right? And that's not just within technology. It's not like someone just whips up, you know, some particular strategy and then they can make $500 million a year, right? You need to have the context of the. So in the situation that, you know, I'm concerned about or, you know, have been concerned about, what you basically had is particular strategies that had, you know, abusive or predatory aspects, and then the exchanges started accommodating and assisting those strategies over a period of, you know, 5 to 10 years, somewhere in there. So, so I think that's what people need to realize is that when you shut these things down, the next one isn't going to pop up, you know, in 6 months. It's it takes a very long time, and that's where we are right now. You know, the industry is with a number of things that have been shut down. Not just my stuff, but there's a lot of reform efforts, especially within the dark pool space. What you see after this is you see people just dealing with the fallout and struggling, right? Then the regulators move on to the next area that is mature. And, you know, right now what you're going to see going in the future is a lot of focus on market manipulation tactics. The primary one that they are putting a ton of effort into is spoofing. And we're seeing... I can't even track the number of spoofing cases now. It seems every you know, few weeks there's a new there's something new within that topic occurring. So it's, you know, that's where all the effort is right now. 2 years ago, a lot of dark pool effort, and 2012, a lot of stuff was focused on the allegations I brought to regulators.
Mm-hmm. If people want to find out more, they can go to your site at highandbodec.com. You're on Twitter as well, and you're very active on Twitter. You post a lot of great stuff about this for people to better understand what's going on, dark pools, high-frequency trading, all that stuff. Your Twitter handle's at highandbodec. The book we spotlighted tonight was The Market Structure Crisis. You also have a compilation book of HFT that that people can find out more about either through Amazon, purchase it that way, or they can find out more from your site, which once again is highandbodec.com. Chaim, thank you so much for coming on the show and all your efforts in trying to bring transparency.
Yeah, let me just add to things. For people who aren't, like, you know, really in the guts of this stuff, usually people, before they write, you know, read my materials, check out the documentary The Wall Street Code by Maria Meerman, and that's on YouTube. So, you know, The Wall Street Code, or just search my name and it'll pop up. And that tells a lot of the story of how I became a whistleblower. And then the other way people usually find out about me is there's a book. It's similar in style to Flash Boys by Michael Lewis. It's called Dark Pools by Wall Street Journal reporter Scott Patterson, and about, you know, a fifth or so of that book also tells my story, and you know, but both those have other people's stories in there. They're great reads for, you know, the lay person or the person who's just some interest in the area. I'd recommend starting there. Unless you're a market structure wonk, then yeah, just go straight to my books.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, Chaim, thank you once again for coming on, and thank you for sending me the book so I can learn more about it myself. It seems that the more I learn about it, the more there is, you know, the further that carrot goes because of how deep some of this has been going on, how widespread it was for so long and still is. But like you said, it is getting better, and your efforts are definitely much appreciated. So thank you again for coming on and what you're doing.
Okay. Thank you.
Take care. Thanks so much.